Welcome back, everyone, to the Faith-Driven Investor Podcast. Once a month, we consider what God has been doing in the world of faith-driven investing and the movements of the global markets. We spend time looking at the big moments and the opportunities to identify places for redemptive work in the world. Tune in now as our panel of guests help us push the conversation forward about faith, investment philosophy, and the frontiers where innovation is happening. Welcome to our special episode, Marks on the Market.
Can we totally dethrone its power from our lives so that all of our work is devoted to God and God's ways?
As Christians, I don't think you can blame it on some evil Hollywood agenda. I think we've abandoned the playing field.
The spirit of David and the cracks of the walls and the schemes that we're all running.
Is you've got to make sure that your identity is solidly rooted in who you are in Christ and not in having money.
If we were to have a business, what would we do with the money? You can only sleep in one bed.
Woke up terrified in the middle of the night. We stole my whole house, was shaken.
We have been put here on earth to create, not to mimic what might have happened historically.
For me, as I pitch, I'm not looking just for the yes, I'm looking for my partners.
But I tried any bind while our ignorance hides. We all wind up here together.
Where my heart is most encouraged as a pastor is when I see generosity as the overflow of someone's intimacy with Jesus.
And there's a lot of people who want to use their influence to change the world. So how do you actually do it?
Investing can be complicated, but it doesn't need to be a burden. Stewardship of the resources that God has entrusted us with is full of responsibility, analysis, and yet it is also a unique opportunity for us all to come to know God's love for us more and his purposes in the world as we seek his wisdom. Here is a place to find other investors who seek the same answers you do and share their stories of seeking to know the best investor and giver of all time. Come for the podcast, stay for the community. Welcome to Faith-Driven Investing.
Hey everyone, all opinions expressed on this podcast, including the team and guests, are solely their opinions. Host and guest may maintain positions in the companies and securities discussed, and this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as specific investment advice for any individual or organization. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Faith-Driven Investor Podcast. This is your host, John Coleman, and we are bringing you our monthly Marks on the Markets. This is where we feature great Christian investors across the spectrum, offering perspectives on current market environments. We are actually recording this right now, just before the holidays, so there will be a longer delay than normal. We usually release this just a few days after recording, but we'll be releasing this after the new year. So happy new year to everyone. We're recording this just on the eve of Christmas right now, and we are hopeful that many of the themes that we talk about will be just as relevant a couple of weeks from now as they are now. I'd like to welcome today our two guests, Jake Thompson, who leads venture capital investing for Sovereigns Capital, and Ben Hames, who's the CEO of 8 Ventures Private Wealth in Atlanta.
Excited to be here. A lot going on in the marketplace and in tech, so I'm pumped to be with you both.
Well, it's wonderful to be here, John. Love the work you guys are doing through Sovereigns, and I look forward to a good conversation today.
Well, today we have a very interesting topic in mind. We want to talk about the great tech reset and whether there is, in fact, some sort of reset going on within technology. Obviously, over the course of the last year, growth in technology stocks in particular have declined. We've seen a slowdown in growth equity and venture capital markets on the private side. And then there have been very high profile examples of disruptions within tech companies like Meta, like Twitter, which we'll dig into a little bit more deeply coming up, and across the board. So the first question I have for you all, and I'll start with Ben, maybe for the public markets perspective and just hear from Jake how that's playing out in private markets. But is the current decline in technology stocks likely to go further?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think we all understand the enhanced risk of what was effectively free money. It's been a very cheap time to hold long-term assets over the last 2 years. And with that, there's a loss of discipline. And so if you look back, you know, a year, 2 years ago, you see some very lofty valuations, particularly tied to non-profitable tech. As you know, as I've been going through year-end meetings and planning meetings for 2023 with clients, you know, we talk about what we did well, what we could have done better. You know, certainly looking, you know, in the mirror as a manager and trying to look at those things in very much of a Warren Buffett annual letter style to look at pros and cons, what we did well, what we could have done better. You know, one of the things that you really needed to do in 2022 as the rates reset and begun to normalize is to have avoided the big pitfalls. And one of those was non-profitable tech, which has just been crushed. You know, our Kathy Wood followers out there have felt the brunt of it. You know, ARK Innovation, ticker symbol ARKK, down 80% off of its highs. And that's really what it is. It's a collection of interesting ideas, futuristic companies, disruptors. You know, but when you cut down to what's the EPS, I think their 2022 number is, you know, almost $6 a share loss, right? And this was trading at 160 plus. You know, now we've lost 80%, but still we're at 30 something dollars a share and we're losing $6 a share, right? The math on that is just so dramatically different when you start to imply a real cost of capital. So, you know, again, you know, as I talk to folks, sometimes clients who were interested in those kind of investments, you know, over the last few years, it's really been a, gosh, it's how do we even think about the value of these things, right? This could be a great idea. This company could, in fact, be a disruptor in the market, but we're just out in space in terms of these valuations. You have a lot of companies who don't even sniff a profit in the near term, and they're trading at tens of billions in valuation. So, you know, again, I think the big thing in 22, as I think about it, is just, you know, really being exposed if you were, you know, pretty heavily invested in non-profitable tech. So, you know, I'll say one other thing and then wrap. You know, as we think about, for example, the tech crash around 2000 and look at where we are today, I mean, you really do, you are anchored today by big, stable, mega tech companies that we live by. And really, those valuations are pretty interesting now. You know, I always go back to Warren Buffett, like a good Christian going to C.S. Lewis and investing. You know, we got everything he has said in his annual letters and parse those and learn from them. But, you know, look, if you like the stock, you know, this company at 40, you should love it at 30 and you should be banging the desk to buy it at 20. And so, you know, I look at Google, I look at even Meta, which is, you know, interesting and risky. This stuff is beginning to look interesting. I mean, Tesla, you know, we're now at 22 times next year's earnings, I think. So again, those that love that at much higher prices should really be interested now.
Yeah, you are right. That's one of the things I see that's different than the dot-com bubble, which we can talk about a little bit. You know, we saw precipitous declines, but at that time, so much of it was really speculative technology, right? There wasn't this floor of companies with genuine business models. Like Tesla is a good company. Amazon's a good company. You know, Meta is a good company in its own right. At least you could argue it is, and profitable, right? Some of these are profitable. And it does feel like a lot of the air has already been let out, although it certainly could face further declines. Jake, how is that playing out in private markets right now?
Yeah, so the private markets really follow the publics so much. And I'd affirm what you guys are saying. I think the SPAC segment of a lot of those tech companies is probably the closest to the dot-com. And I think we've seen a lot of that air let out, as you mentioned, John. And I even think, you know, Ben, you're talking about Google and others. It feels to me that there's an upward pressure on a lot of these companies that are inherently still very high quality. They're cutting a lot of costs, right? Google is expected next year probably to cut 10,000 people. Right? That an average salary of $300,000, that's $3 billion that's going to go to the bottom line almost overnight. And so you think about just that upward pressure, we're below the long-term valuation multiples, and yet interest rates are still climbing, right? I think what we saw in the dot-com bubble was as soon as everything popped, started getting a little bit higher quality in the fundamentals, and then interest rates started going back down from, call it 6.5% to 1%, that's where you really saw things starting to come back. So that's what we're watching for on the public side, because it does inform everything in the private markets. The later stages in private markets, 10, you know, call it series B, C, D plus, really mimics those public markets. What we're seeing really interestingly on the earliest stages of seed, especially, is there's still so much dry powder out there, so much that's sitting in funds, still $200 billion or so, that there are many fewer deals being done on the seed side, and yet the valuations are staying pretty steady. So it'll be interesting to see. From my vantage point, are rates going to come back and the public markets recover? before all that seed capital is deployed and those valuations start to normalize a little bit too. But that's the big unknown right now that we're watching. But certainly seeing a lot of those valuations that have come down seem to be pretty steady below the long-term averages. And that makes for a pretty compelling market to be investing in.
You know, you touched on one topic that I'm interested in, Jake, and I'd put this to either of you. I remember the very first time I visited Northern California to look at tech companies back in graduate school. I visited one of these companies we've named, which shall remain nameless. And it was just overwhelming, the amenities when you walked in the door, right? There were, you know, recycled rainforest wood floors, and you were never more than 100 feet from a full kitchen, and, you know, all this sorts of stuff that tech has become just notorious for, right? Profligate spending, incredible benefits, great if you're working there, but the culture was one where money flowed freely and there were tons of fringe benefits. Now we're really seeing the first round of layoffs with this new era of tech, even at the big and profitable companies like Meta. Is that going to change culture? You know, do you think these layoffs are going to be consistent throughout the industry? Do you think cost saving now becomes something that tech companies look to generate profitability, to your point, Ben? And what does that do to the culture of Silicon Valley and the culture of technology?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's really part of this reset where you do have a real cost of capital now, and you have a new focus on the bottom line and earnings per share. You know, not to suggest that 2021 for Meta is, you know, should be the baseline or what we would consider normalized earnings. But, you know, at the moment, and it varies, you know, moment by moment, day to day. But, you know, we're trading at about 8 times 2021 earnings for Meta. I mean, we start thinking about companies that get in the mode of, you know, manufacturing earnings, what you can do with the levers of expenses and hiring and whatnot. I mean, this is by many measures a very cheap company if they want to continue to do what they've done. And it talks a little bit more about Meta, though, and which I think is such an interesting investment case right now. You know, they have that problem of this is, you know, a industrialist who's been very successful at everything they've done. And now they want your money to go and, you know, have a number of vineyards, right? So they're kind of transforming themselves as they transformed into the metaverse, you know, dominant player, into something different, right? So there's a lot of concern that goes with that, and the expenses have been through the roof in that transition. So again, that's part of the thing that makes this such a difficult case to analyze in terms of a future investment. But again, I think you're seeing those companies, you know, Google, Meta, you know, begin to cut costs to focus on that. And I think that bodes well for tech investors.
Yeah, I jump on that and say, it seems like a lot of these companies are going to follow the playbook that you see Microsoft and others playing, where you get to a certain level of maturity and you can start to wring out some of the costs, and Wall Street really responds to that. And this is a time in the cycle where some of these companies are looking for that impact for shareholders. So I do think we're headed that way. Even the dynamics, the fundamentals of back 10, 15 years ago, you had 10% of graduates in Silicon Valley were computer science majors, right? These days, it's more like 50 to 60%. You're starting to see that supply, which sure, there's a bit of a long tail to get in the system. But once they're in there, there's just a lot less competition for them. So I think you're going to see more of these, maybe almost in a ratchet effect. We're bringing it down as part of the cycle. I don't know if they're necessarily going to come back, but I do think it'll impact culture just because a lot of folks didn't sign up to be at these kinds of, almost feels like a PE style, bring out the costs, right? To figure out how to increase the bottom line. A lot of these tech folks, they sign on to very different companies. So it'll be interesting to see how that change in culture impacts retention of a lot of those developers at the top tech companies.
Well, and I want to zero in on the people side of this, Jake, because you and I have talked about it before. I'm just consistently struck when I look at technology companies, particularly bigger ones, how few people within the companies are actually engineers, though. You know, there are a number of different positions. I can't, for the life of me, understand a lot of titles within the companies and just understand what people do. And I think this idea that tech might be radically overstaffed, so not like 10, 20% overstaffed, but potentially 50, 60, 75% overstaffed, really came to a head with the Twitter acquisition by Elon Musk, right? I mean, in the first 3 weeks, he took that organization from 7,500 people to 2,700 people, right? In the course of 3 weeks. And we're not arguing necessarily that that was done well or that that's the right way to do things. But I know a lot of folks in Silicon Valley have been watching to say, like, oh my gosh, are we really operating at more than twice the number of people we need to do well? And have we so overstaffed on non-engineering or non-technical people that we're actually diluting the impact that those folks can have? What do you think about that? Because I actually believe it could be true in a lot of tech companies that they could be twice overstaffed what they need to be effective. But maybe Jake, starting with you and then to you, Ben, I mean, what do you see? Do you think that might be the right case? Or do you think that that swung too far, that what happened at Twitter was ineffective there or couldn't be as effective in other places?
That message resonates for me for public companies and later stage companies. And I'll just acknowledge too, of course, we're talking about big numbers of job losses and the rest. And yeah, it's really easy to talk about them as numbers, right? So just want to acknowledge and honor that these are individuals and families, and that's hard. So I'll start with that. But what we've seen is a lot of these tech companies, you grow to a certain size if you're a public tech company, and there's a sense where complacency is forgiven, right? Where it's not the same scrappiness, right? Elon got at this where it's like, hey, we're going to work long hours and we might even work on weekends, right? Which had a lot of people up in arms because it's getting back to the roots of really hard work. And this is completely anecdotal and unfair because I know it's incredible individuals at all these companies. But I think about the developers at top tech companies, public companies that I know, they're probably putting in 30, 35 hours a week, right? That in some cases includes video game time, right? And these really, really fun jobs. And the developers I know and all the startups that we back are putting in at least double that, right? It's just a totally different culture. So I think there is some element of that culture and that what some might call bloat that you simply can get rid of and the company's going to be okay. But there's also a very rational side of that that I'd say, where tech companies tend to be these lean startup mentalities, right? Build, measure, learn. You don't always know what the market wants. So go build something, see how it reacts. Where do we reinvest then? And when capital is cheap or free, it makes a lot of sense to overstaff to go seed something to see where it goes. But once capital starts to increase in its cost, then all of a sudden the ROI of those kinds of endeavors, whether they're moonshots or everyday efficiencies, that starts to go down. So I think there's a very rational case to be made where when capital is cheap, you kind of want to air toward the bloat in tech. And then now that it's coming back down, become more expensive, you're going to see a lot of those that they just no longer make sense to have those positions.
Yeah, well, great insights, Jake. You have a lot more experience on the ground with those companies and operators. But, you know, I will say, I reflect on what has been some bizarre business news stories of the last couple of years related to this. You know, one being the collusion amongst tech companies to not poach from one another, which is just such an, you know, an odd time. You know, but then also the later variety of that story has been the hoarding talent, you know, that you would have these counter accusations between these big hire entities where they're, you know, you don't need these people. You're hiring all these extra folks and taking them from the market and harming the market in general. You know, again, a very strange time. You know, I will say a lot of the broader discussion in the economy right now, and certainly with markets, is about, you know, will we have a significant recession going into 2023? You know, and I think a big part of that is hiring. We're talking a little bit about layoffs in the tech space, and we're just focused on tech in general today. But more broadly speaking, you know, hiring is still happening at a pretty robust clip. I think in 2019, the average monthly new hires was 164,000. Latest numbers from November, 264,000. So the hiring is still rapid in the face of this Fed hike campaign. So, you know, again, we're getting some headlines with some of the tech layoffs and these big companies, and again, some new fiscal discipline that I think most tech investors will welcome. But as of right now, I think there's 4 million more job openings that are unemployed Americans. Yep. And this is a big part of the recession discussion, the inflation discussion, but still persistent inflationary pressure on the wage front. As you look beyond tech and across the economy, significant tightness in the labor market.
Well, and that's what is so interesting right now, right? Because typically when you raise rates like this, it does cause a recession. There's a chance we're in a recession now. There's a chance that we'll see that deepen next year. But thus far, it really hasn't played out in employment, right? The labor markets are still relatively tight. Consumer spending seems to be relatively strong right now. There are certain segments that are very interest rate dependent that I've obviously got hit very hard, you know, new home building or mortgages, et cetera, are in a difficult spot right now because of rates. But there hasn't been the kind of real economy hit that I think you would expect after such dramatic rate tightening yet. And the question is, of course, whether that does hit. Don't want to spend too much time on this necessarily, but it's hard to talk about technology right now without talking about the private company, Twitter, and obviously the activities of Elon Musk. As of this recording, Musk has done a survey on Twitter about whether he should be CEO and has decided to step down. There are a whole host of implications because Musk is really at the top of a number of the most innovative companies in the world, right? SpaceX, Tesla, Neuralink, and now Twitter, all in very different areas. And he seems to have his hands on a lot of those spaces. Right now, Tesla stock is cratering as a result, partially of people believing that he's distracted. Twitter obviously took on a lot of debt. Maybe just starting out of the gates, I mean, Jake, what's your impression of what's going on out there? And is Elon still, you know, a genius who's going to be able to turn all this stuff around? Or has he finally met his match in what he's taken on here? What's your read on what everyone's talking about right now in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, the only thing I can say with confidence is I've considered canceling my Netflix subscription and just reading Elon's tweets over the last few weeks because they are, oh my gosh, they're golden at times. And it is, it's, you know, you would not expect a public company CEO to be engaging in some of those ways, but it's anybody's guess. You know, some folks will say, why is he wasting all this time here where he has all these world-changing companies that he should be leading and really focusing on? And I think there's a case to be made that Twitter is our de facto public square, right? It's worth the focus of somebody really, really smart. And I do think that he's working really hard to extricate himself from Twitter. He's trying to hand it over to some folks that, at least from what some people are saying, weren't that interested in taking it on. So he doesn't have the heir apparent at this point. But I would say, yeah, it turns out empirically, there are really only three categories or three times where a public company CEO deeply drives an outcome in terms of value creation. The first one is when they are the ones that are setting culture. Right. And there's more research on this happening in the faith-driven sphere, especially. Second one is when there's a major transition. The third one is when the company is a very innovative company and the CEO is driving that innovation, a la Steve Jobs. And so it's such a good question. Long way of just getting my affirmation of your question, because he's such a smart, gifted guy who probably does drive the value that a lot of these companies are delivering, especially the earlier ones like the Neuralinks and others that are potential categories in the future that need him in the earlier days more than maybe a Tesla does or others that have a bevy of engineers and leaders. But it's certainly a notable time to watch a leader like Elon.
Yeah, what do you think, Ben? I mean, you're watching this. You've talked about like Tesla before.
I'll try not to get too lost in the weeds of the momentary headlines, which Elon is really good at creating. You know, I hope in the rearview mirror a year, 10 years from now, Elon Musk will be a champion for free speech. And I think he is positioned to do that. Maybe he does that more effectively as the owner and not the guy who's, you know, fighting with tweets. It's hard to do, right? It's hard to do well over an extended period of time. You know, if I am a significant Tesla investor, I probably would love the idea of him not continuing to operate as he has in these first few days and weeks. So, yeah, it remains to be seen.
Well, and, you know, he's got good teams there. I think everybody knows that SpaceX, Tesla, and Neuralink are now, or at least SpaceX and Tesla seem really deep. I'm less knowledgeable about Neuralink. Like you said, Jake, you know, part of me thinks, gosh, you're getting to Mars, creating full autonomy, creating human computer interfaces. Like, why?
And doing the blue check. One of these things does not belong. Yeah,
exactly. But you're right. I mean, this is, look, if you think about the culture, this idea of a public space of speech, of what's acceptable, of how we should communicate with each other is a cultural touchstone right now. And certainly his instincts have been very strong historically about what was needed in the moment. And those companies seem to be creating durable value. I mean, you look at SpaceX, not only are they going to Mars, but they have the broadest satellite network in the world now. I mean, they're delivering internet to Ukraine right now and to hurricane-stricken areas. It's just fascinating to see what that will look like in the future. Moving to another pretty notable entrepreneur right now, Mark Zuckerberg. You know, Mark made this massive bet in transitioning Facebook to Meta, moving away from social network to creating the metaverse. And I think he's bet billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars on creating the metaverse. And so far, Meta has really gotten punished in the public markets, partially as a result of the downturn, but partially because a lot of the hoped for success in the metaverse, at least within the context of that company, has not materialized. Jake, I know you've invested in the space. Is the metaverse dead, or are we going to see some sort of resurrection here? And is Zuckerberg on the right track, or do you think there's actually needed a pivot right now in how we think about it?
I don't think the metaverse is dead. I would probably, as a meta observation, so to speak, I'd say this is a reasonable bet from his perspective, because you see the long arc of innovation is that some of these hardwares over the last 30 plus years have gone from desktop to laptop to mobile. And Lott would say that augmented reality, virtual reality would be the next on that path, right? And they're increasingly ubiquitous. They're increasingly immersive. They're increasingly part of our lives. And so it's not crazy to think, especially when glasses come out, right? Where you're almost RoboCop style. You put on the glasses, you can see through them, but maybe the three of us can be sitting in a room engaging with each other, right? For instance. And people oftentimes think of virtual reality, which is a little clunkier, fewer use cases. But as Oculus comes out with its Pro headset, which is already announced, as Apple comes out with the headset next year, I think we're going to see continued interest in this. I don't know if it's truly going to be the integral part of our lives that Zuckerberg hopes, but I think it's a reasonable bet, because what he's doing is he's standing against the innovator's dilemma, right? Where you get to be such a big company and something is working, and that thing that is working, all the stakeholders have an incentive to just keep focusing on that. And then eventually somebody leapfrogs you because you're not thinking ahead. But he's investing downstream of consumer behavior. And that's a really important thing that startups can do, but oftentimes public companies can't necessarily. But because of the voting structure, which has frustrated some folks, he's able to. So I think the metaverse holds a lot of promise. It probably doesn't look a lot like what most folks think it would. And from Meta's perspective, I think it's a reasonable bet, at least in the medium term.
What do you think, Ben? What's your metaverse avatar right now?
That's what I wanted to get into. I was hoping we would go there. I have mixed comments here. You know, first and foremost, you know, more of us living more in an alternate universe and taking advantage of the kind of products that will be offered in the metaverse strikes me as a dystopian situation. But from an investment perspective, you know, there has been this trend, as Jake outlines, of, you know, further and further entrenchment into our lives and more time spent aiming and interacting virtually. I mean, my goodness, just think of Zoom and its competitors and how that's reshaped work life. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. You know, again, I think if I could just talk a little bit about the investment case for Meta, you know, there's part of you that has to keep in mind the ability that they would have to just retrench and go back to the tried and true model that they have and pull those levers. And all of a sudden you have something that's really valuable and not that risky and trading at, you know, pretty cheap price. And so, you know, again, I sort of view it as this may be a disaster, you know, for Meta in terms of the foray into the metaverse and the big expenses, but it may in the end be a blip and they go back to, you know, the old Facebook and advertising and making a whole lot of money.
Yeah. And, you know, the other Elon twist here that's interesting from my perspective is, you know, it's been a taboo topic forever to have social media companies charge their users, right? It's been an advertising model. The user has been the product. They sell data, et cetera. And Elon has kind of opened Pandora's box, so to speak, on trying to charge people for the blue checks, which Jake noted, $8 or $11 if you're on the Apple store. And one thing I'm interested in watching is if that does get some traction, which seems moderate so far, whether that impacts the core business models of some of the other social companies and whether they try and adopt that much the way that media companies have. You know, media companies, for a long time, it was thought that online information was going to be free, and now paywalls have gone up around a number of media companies, and even Substack, which is something in between social media and a media company, obviously charges for newsletters or has authors charge for newsletters. So I'm fascinated to see where that ends up as well and what the charge model will look like moving forward. To speak of a more precipitous and obvious decline before moving into something really interesting and hopeful that's happened, as of this recording, very recent news, Sam Bankman-Fried is on his way back to the United States where he faces potential jail time, or I think he may have already been transferred to the pen in New York. News today was that his two counterparts, Caroline Ellison and one of his co-founders, have turned on him, so have pled guilty to their charges and are theoretically cooperating with authorities. And FTX obviously just suffered a precipitous collapse. Kind of the same question with the metaverse. With the collapse of FTX, with the collapse of so many coins around this, Web 3.0 was supposed to be the next big thing between Bored Apes and cryptocurrencies and these exchanges. Is that dead? Is Web 3.0? Do we need to find a Web 4.0 now? What's next, Jake?
Yeah, I'd say it's not dead, but is it indeed hungover? So it feels dead, but it's going to pull itself out of bed. It's
mostly dead, as they say in The Princess Bride. Or
yeah, that's right. Here, drink this. But it's going to nurse itself back to health. And I delineate two different parts of this, right? One is the core Web 3, the blockchain technology part, aside from crypto. And to me, that feels like such a logical progression. To say it is an inevitable is a very strong word, but to use a taxonomy, right? Web one was we read the internet, right? Web two is we read and write, right? Blogs and Facebook and the rest. Web three is really about reading, writing, and owning. We own our information. We own our content. Mm. We own our contributions. We benefit from contributions to social networks, right? And that is something consumers are going to want. There's going to be consumer demand. So those companies that are building on a Web3 blockchain technology are going to be the ones that do very well in the future. So I don't think it's, as a category, it's dead. What I do think is we're not going to talk about it quite as much. In the same way, we don't talk about internet companies. We don't talk about AI companies. We just talk about tech companies because those things have become such an integral part of those technology stacks. They're just part of companies now. I think we're going to see the most innovative tech companies built on Web3 infrastructure. They won't be a Web3 company. They'll just be a tech company. So I think that'll stick around. It'll be maybe a little more muted longer term. But in terms of crypto, which is the juicy part of the sector, I tell you that the analogy that resonates for me is it is a forest that was in need of a fire for its own long-term health, right? Huh. It's hard, really hard in the meantime, but you gotta have that pruning of the ecosystem so it can really grow. And as we've talked about before, there are just thousands and thousands of coins that probably shouldn't exist. I think a lot of those go away. Even the really good coins that weren't the main ones, but some of the altcoins and that, but had really good business cases, I think they had a problem of governance, right? Where you would have some of these founders that made their money before they really created value. So they cashed out and they weren't aligned long-term because they're in the tokens rather than the equity. What I do think is FTX, this whole debacle, is going to put a focus on governance that investors will say, all right, I like this project, but we're going to make sure we align these interests. And that's going to enable these incredible founders with good technologies, good products to actually come out of the rubble. I think there will be a handful of some of the best Web3 crypto companies that will come out of this time, but it's not a space that I would necessarily recommend anybody go and start pouring lots of money into right at this point.
When I like your description, Web 3.0 is about what we own. And part of the FTX debacle, right, was people thought they owned something that was actually being traded and owned by Alameda Research, right? Which was SPF's effectively personal family office. And that was, all of this is allegedly, of course, but you know, that was a real betrayal of the underlying infrastructure of that and people becoming nervous about what they actually own.
Well, I'm going to add too that the Web3 enthusiasts would say, well, the big problem is that was a centralized exchange. So the problem with Web3 is that could have been DeFi, decentralized finance, where you didn't have somebody like SBF that's calling all these shots, and he would be unable to do that because the math would be unable to do that, right? An algorithm can't go buy a penthouse in the Bahamas, right? Only a person can. And so a lot of folks would say if that were truly set up on Web3 infrastructure to then trade Web3 assets, then you wouldn't have had the FTX debacle.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I hear a lot of versions of that with regard to crypto and what's happened in the last year, which, you know, again, maybe there's some merit there, but it strikes me as very similar to the arguments we always hear about communism. It's never been practiced true to its form. It's never been done well. And if it were, it would create a utopia. But, you know, you think about all the things that, and I'm, you know, I'm out there and have been for a long time. I'm not a fan of crypto. You know, all the things that it was supposed to solve, you know, it really has failed with flying colors quickly. You know, yeah, again, and you see, you know, there's an effort to differentiate, right? Is it Bitcoin is the thing? You know, I'm in that crowd. I can't get past. I don't know why it's worth anything, right? I mean, was it overvalued at 60,000? Now it's worth 16. You know, again, we kind of go back to some of those valuation discussions we had earlier, thinking about valuing companies by that old P ratio, or, you know, we haven't talked about some of the alternative valuation methods, but, you know, the rule of 40 or some of the things that people would use in the tech space, you know, where we have some tools where we can try to assess and apply value. You know, to me, the fact that blockchain technology is a valuable technology, or, you know, and will continue to be more valuable in the future, it just implies no particular value to crypto, right? I mean, it's a non sequitur that Bitcoin is worth $500, much less $17,000, because blockchain technology is valuable. I mean, that's the case I would make. And so, again, I just can't get comfortable with this at any price.
Well, and Jake, since Ben did just call you a communist, I think you get to respond.
Well, those are good thoughts, comrade. But no, those are all great thoughts and the right kind of question that we need to be holding the industry to over time. I suspect, you know, you see all the innovation come out of the bull markets there. And I do think there's more value that's created over time. It's got to have an actual problem being solved, whereas much of it doesn't yet. So a little bit to be determined. And it's a fair critique. Absolutely.
So I want to kind of close, we're going to close formally on asking what you guys are learning through scripture right now that you want to share with others. But as we pivot, you know, we're thinking about a great tech reset, right? There's been a collapse in these markets. They're undergoing layoffs. Like the dot-com bubble, what came out of that was much different than what went in, right? We came out with a more stable base of real companies that were growing after that. As you guys look at what's happening today, and we reset valuations in technology and also potentially where people are focused, what are you most excited about in technology right now? So maybe, Ben, start with you, but are there areas of technology that you're excited about investing right now?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to pick the winners in this space. And so partially, I've sort of hedged the bet in this space by making some broader plays. But I really like cyber. I think that's a part of the spin that is going to grow. You know, I think that, you know, we've recently seen in business news, there's a large Zelle fraud going on, and the banks are working together to determine how to, you know, refund those defrauded and that sort of thing. But again, it's hitting us on all fronts. That's a space that I want to be in, want to be exposed to, have been, and continue to think that's an important place for folks to have exposure.
Jake, what do you think? Where are you guys focused as you look at early stage tech companies right now?
Yeah, I'll offer a bit more general answer and more stage focus. And that's really in the Series A. As I mentioned, that's an area that I've started to see the valuations coming down. A lot of companies that raise, call it 12 to 18 months of capital in the last year. So they're coming up maybe mid-2023 to raise capital. If you find a company that is capital efficient, actually solving a big problem with a gritty creative leader, there are a lot of companies that unfortunately are folding during this time. I think PE is going to take out a lot of the other ones that are at really good valuations. So I think the playing field is going to be winnowed a bit. And these are going to be the types of companies that longer term are going to be successful. I think the valuations make that even more than seed and more than later stage really compelling, particularly because seed and Series A tend to be the highest performing in terms of internal rate of return for early stage. So that's what we're really looking at over the next 6 to 9 months in particular.
That's great. And I would just add two thoughts from my end. One thing that's really caught my attention lately is artificial intelligence, with ChatGPT coming out and proving some of the power of that technology, and that we actually have crossed a threshold at which that technology has consumer applications and is good, right? You use ChatGPT, and for its current use case, it's actually a remarkable piece of programming, a remarkable piece of technology that's likely to unlock a number of other things, both good and bad. But AI is on my radar. And I still think we're going to see a lot of innovation in healthcare right now, particularly remote delivery of healthcare, telehealth, virtual healthcare. You know, that was a hot item during the pandemic because people couldn't get physically to their healthcare. But it just seems like a lot of the stickiness of that model is starting to manifest in the market. And I think there's a lot of innovation to continue to happen in the space of more bespoke healthcare delivery, particularly things like telehealth, which is one thing I think will make people's lives better, but also could present some interesting investments. You know, we always like to close this because it's the Faith-Driven Investor podcast. And I know you two are both great men of faith, with you offering just your thoughts on what God's teaching you through scripture right now that you might want to share with others. And so if you don't mind, Jake, we might start with you, and then Ben, you can close us out.
I'd be happy to set the bar very low. So we're going through a study. This is actually at work with our investment team, going through a study now. And what we highlighted recently was joy. And I was just very struck reading through scripture about joy, of how elusive sometimes true deep joy can be. And there's a quick framework of this, that joy involves, step one, just recognize the way that Christ is in the day-to-day, right? Of all the various blessings that we have. Number two, trust him in those moments where it's not necessarily easy to see how things work out. And number three, thank him, right? Almost the discipline of thanksgiving, and how if we can do those things consistently, it cultivates joy in our hearts. And this has been a big blessing to dive into the topic of joy in this season, even with everything going on in the markets, where it's easy for our heads to be steady and the rest, and yet our hearts to still go up and down with the market.
It's a good word, Jake. Pastor Ben, what do you think?
It'll be tough to follow that. You know, I will reflect on something Aaron and I recently, of course, Aaron's my wife. We were recently reflecting on, we have for 20 plus years now practiced the Sabbath. I guess it's been about 20 years, but through study and while we were in seminary, we determined that we should continue to honor and practice the Sabbath in a way that is sort of countercultural, even within Christian circles. And you know, as we reflected on 20 years of doing that, you know, I can recall that early along at certain points, you know, it would, I guess, on occasions feel somewhat restricted to the things that we said that we wouldn't do on Sunday. You know, as we look back through the seasons of our life now, 20 years of marriage, and now I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, this has been such a gift, right, to have this sacred day that we'll, you know, we won't lead our ox into the ditch. We'll do the work. We'll do all the things we need to do to have that day set aside and to, you know, disallow ourselves or to imagine that God intends for us not to work and have others work in our stead on that day. You know, in a busy world, in a stressful 2 or 3 years here with COVID and these things, that has been such an incredible gift for us. And just, I think, imparted such peace, such time for worship, for family time, when we just said, this is what we can do. I mean, I'm reminded of an old Hebrew parable where, you know, there's a gentleman who's walking in his field on a Sabbath day and he sees a fence that needs repair. And he has this idea that he won't even be able to repair it because he saw it on the Sabbath, right? But, you know, just that kind of idea that we've tried to live out and done it, you know, no doubt very roughly and poorly by some measures, certainly of some of our Jewish friends that do it so well. But I would just commend, you know, some type of Sabbath to all my friends and those I would care about as something that's just been very life-giving for us as a family.
Amen and amen. Well, Jake Thompson, Ben Hames, we are really grateful for you spending time with us today on the Faith Driven Investor podcast. I know I feel like I'm leaving with a better perspective on technology in the marketplace, and certainly the wisdom that you shared on your own faith journeys has been important. So thank you all for joining us today, and we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you both.
We are grateful for the opportunity to serve this community and see listeners come in from more than 100 countries. Faith-driven investing can be a lonely journey, but it doesn't have to be. The best way to stay connected is to join a group study with other investors looking to get the same answers to questions you have and find great community as they do so. There's no cost, no catch. In person or online, you can meet an hour a week with other peers from your backyard or the other side of the world. You can also stay connected by signing up for our monthly newsletter at faithdriveninvesting.org. This podcast wouldn't be possible without the help of many of our friends. Executive producer Justin Foreman, intro mixed and arranged by Summer Dregs, audio and editing by Richard Barley. Our theme song is Sweet Ever After by Ellie Holcomb.